Blog Talk Radio.
On Wheels Now.
Welcome to On Wheels Now, your local sports radio show with your step-in temporary host, Cindy Clark. Also, the awesome seven-time champion, Gary Wyatt. And it's brought to you by Reliable Banner, Here Clear, the late model truck series, and Gary's Trailer Repair. Tonight, we're going to be joined by the famous, world-famous, TJ Clark. But before we do, Gary,
world famous.
Yes. Gary, I want to talk to you about, so I've been watching this show for like 17 years and you never talk about Gary's Trailer Repair. But you have an awesome trailer repair and everybody that watches the show
knows I have a trailer knows I have a trailer repair.
But they don't know how awesome of a trailer repair you are. Like, you could call you any time of the day or night, and if you're awake and you answer, you'll just come over and fix their stuff.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes, yes.
And,
I do that.
And you do it well. Like not just like hack and thrash, like you have a full truck. Like you're a professional.
Yes.
How did you get into doing trailer repair?
I've been doing trailer repair for many years.
I know, but there's like race cars and that's cool and they're working on cars. But then like, you're like, you know what? I want to work on the trailer. How's that happen?
I started at U-Haul.
Really?
Yes. In 1986.
When you were 6 years old?
Four.
4 years old. Okay. And so what, just renting trucks or you had to fix up stuff? Or?
No, I started in their hit shop.
Okay.
Running their hit shop.
And then you're like, man, I know how to do this stuff. Forget you, Homa Dumont.
A couple of days later, I decided to do it on my own.
Like, yeah, I got this.
Yeah.
So then you're like, I'm going to do my own. So how many years have you been doing your own trailer repair business?
February will be 26.
26 years.
On my own, yes.
Now, how come you don't talk about it on the show?
Because everybody that knows me knows what I do for a living.
What about new people that come onto the show?
They obviously have friends.
Well, I'm here to plug Gary's Trailer Repair. I've used him on several occasions, and he just comes right over and fixes your shit. And if you're nice to him, he'll even let you come over here and he'll fix your shit. So
yes.
That's pretty cool. So, like trailers, like 18-wheelers or car trailers? Or what's
Travel
your limit?
Trailers, utility trailers, car trailers.
All
right. Nothing along the lines of big tractor trailers.
You just fix them or you sell them?
Nope, just fix them.
So
I don't sell
just
them.
Entire axles?
Yep.
Hitches?
Axles, wheels, hitches.
All right.
Anything to do with towing.
So if you are taking a race car to a racetrack that's actually open and you get a flat or you have a wheel bearing problem, how do they get a hold of you?
They look me up on Facebook. No. They call me.
And your phone number is?
702-501-7115.
That's cool. Maybe Gary's Trailer and Hitch Repair will sponsor me.
Yeah.
Maybe. So I bring that up because somebody went to prompt this last week. Was anybody else out there go to prompt last weekend? And
Mike Montez is right.
What do you say?
Most people overlook their trailer.
Yeah, that's true, until it breaks down, right?
Yep.
Okay, so I'm thinking about, I got to get my trailer ready because they're actually racing in Pahrump. And Mike Montez put on quite the show in Pahrump until he got taken out, unfortunately. It kind of looks intentional. I don't know. What do you think, Mike? Do people intentionally take each other out there?
Not in Pahrump.
Not in Pahrump. Okay.
No.
So, because it's
I'll
like
answer
that,
for him. No, not
like,
in
they're pretty strict about that out there, actually. No, so it was huge car counts. Is it always huge car counts, or is that because there's
it's
no
been
racing?
Growing? No,
before?
It's been growing.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm glad to see that there were 17 minis.
Yeah, so what happened with that is I called her and I was like, how can you get a bigger rate car? Well, I don't have a full cage, but you can get a full cage from Chris Klein's business. He's a left-hander dealer, and they sell cages. It's like $350 for the whole kit. So go on Craigslist, get a junker. That's just be four banger. It can be front or rear drive. I read the rules. Oh. You can get a cage from Chris Klein.
I recommend a Ford.
And then, me too, because that means you're going to be behind me.
Uh-huh.
And then you can go racing in per hump. There was quite a few, there was a few people from the bowling that brought their skid plate cars out there. Like, I was thinking TJ, this guy TJ, not TJ Card was coming in, but another guy TJ that races skid plates, he's in the school district, he's a school teacher. So guess he's been off since March doing nothing. So he puts a full cage in his skid plate car. And he went out there and had fun. And guess what I had to do? Watch. But I think I'm going to have to put a cage in my car.
I think so.
And I think the Golden Knight will too. And maybe if we bring our theme race cars out there, other people will too. Because I know like Chris Klein's crew chief, he's red. So he could be like the Red Rocket. And put like a rocket on it. And I could bring my cape and my tiara. And the Golden Knight, although they lost last night, so they are not.
Yes, they did.
Shut up.
Yes, they
Kings
did.
Fan, you.
Uh-huh.
You jinx
it. Oh, they're going to join them. They're going to join them on the beach.
Is that where the Kings are?
Probably.
Yeah, you don't know where they are because they weren't even in the playoffs.
Nope,
so
they wasn't. Not
how
this
that?
Year.
So how can you possibly talk about the Golden Knight?
Hey.
So.
How'd the Golden Knights do last night?
Well, you know what? They did okay. They went all the way to overtime.
Uh-huh.
And then they just, you know, I don't know what happened. And then they got their puck in the net before
the Knights did?
Yeah.
Were you watching it?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, as I'm looking up what
kind
parts
of
I need.
Kind of a waste of time, huh?
No. It was in between looking up parts I'm going to need to make my skid plate car legal for per hump. So bad.
That's the best thing Mike Montez has said for a long time.
He doesn't like them because Dennis says they're going to go play golf because one of them, just one, Mike, one of them took a knee, which he says you should only take a knee if you're praying, which I agree.
Yes.
So take a knee if you're praying. There's another reason. So he's like not ever going to watch them again. Montez.
Yes.
That's all right.
Try again next year.
Try again next year. And, you know, it's the first year with their new coach, so maybe it's just new coach.
Oh, no. If you ask anybody, it's the coach's fault.
It's always the coach's fault. Uh-huh. That's why they got rid of the last one.
Uh-huh.
This one didn't do much better, so I don't know what to say about that.
But he got handed a bunch of losing players.
No, they're all okay, so back to racing.
Yes.
I didn't know I'm talking about that. So, it was fun to go out there and racing. It was fun, too, because with the COVID thing, we've all had to isolate. It was fun to be around a bunch of people. Although, if you're going to go out and watch, they did cap it.
Yeah,
so, if you showed up late, you couldn't get in. So, TJ, come on in here and sit next to me.
I'm late. What do you mean? I can't get in.
Uh-oh.
She's moving. At Pahrump, the fans filled up, the stands filled up, and they had to actually turn people away. Like, that's never happened at the boring. I'm just saying.
That's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So, TJ, we got you your favorite drink.
Hey, I brought one.
I won't tell your wife, who says you're not allowed to have soda anymore.
You're like my wife, and my wife's not around.
Is that a good thing or a not so good thing? I'm giving you a soda.
Depends how you look at it.
Well, welcome, TJ.
Thanks very much, Cindy.
Even though we have the same last name, I'm just so honored that we have the same last name. But we're not even related, but I feel like or kin. Anyways, so you've been racing a little bit longer than me. Tell me, like, how did you get into racing?
Does that mean, like, I'm a little older than you?
No, you've just been racing longer.
Okay.
I didn't start till college.
College?
Yeah.
There's no college in racing.
That's what happened. So I might have used all my student loans. But, yeah, look at how great my college education got me to a skip lane car at the bull ring.
Yeah, if we could only all look back on that.
Yeah.
What should I have done?
Well, I would do what you did. You've lived
that.
The life. You're the man, the myth, the legend.
Well, you got some pretty big boots on there, lady.
I knew you were coming.
Shoveling it out.
No, but I mean, you're obviously a super famous race car driver, but how did you start?
I don't know where you get that. I'm not that.
I haven't.
I was the exact opposite of that. I raced with some pretty famous guys, but I wasn't the famous guy. I was the little guy working his way in.
Yeah.
And I was okay with that.
How did you get started racing?
That's a good question. I've raced about everything.
I know.
I was racing jet skis way back in the day here out of Las Vegas.
When you were in high school?
No, right out of high school. When I was in high school, I drag raced. My father, that's how I got started. My father was a drag racer. So as a kid, I went to the drag races every weekend. And at 14, I think he snuck me in a car. I started driving a drag car.
Nice.
Which was cool.
You liked it?
I did. I still like drag racing. It's not the funnest. Racing is a lot of work. So to me, the more time you have in a car, the more that work feels like you have paid off.
Yeah.
And drag racing is not that. It's exhilarating, but I did more street racing than I did drag strip racing as I got older, to be honest.
Yeah. So you went to high school here in Vegas?
I did.
Were you born here?
No. I'm a Texan.
Texan?
Out of Texas.
How did you get to Vegas?
My parents were in the military. My father was in the Air Force. And we moved around a lot. I say I'm a Texan, but I was only there for a year. But every time I drive through, I say, I'm a Texan.
Do you get twang in your voice?
Yeah. So we do a little moving around. I've lived in quite a few places, and just my dad was always into cars and always into drag racing. And as a kid, you just, you look up to your father. You try to do what he does. He was probably a little disappointed in me once I got out of the drag racing thing, but I learned some lessons early on, and I was fortunate enough to realize that I probably couldn't make a living or money in drag racing. Would have liked to, but couldn't figure out a way to do that in those days. Not that I was looking to make a living in racing, but it just kind of all played that way. It worked out for me, as time went on. I was living in Phoenix, working, actually painting cars and working for a jet ski shop and racing go-karts. My brother and I would meet up different tracks around California area, running a Formula 125 shifter cart class, which was very new at the time and really popular. And then a professional group of guys got together and started racing. There was factory Kawasaki, Yamaha, Honda, Suzuki, and we were the little independent guys. We'd show up in the back of our truck, pickup truck, all of our junk. Everybody else show up in their box vans at the time. That was like having a semi-rig. And we just whip butt on them.
Oh, yeah.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. And that propelled me. A guy named Bob Bondurant, I'm sure a lot of people heard of him.
Yeah.
He was at the racetrack, and he heard that I lived in Phoenix. And he came over and talked to me and said, hey, you live in Phoenix? Yes, sir. And I didn't know who Bob Bondurant was, and that was a no-no. Because Bob Bondurant was like,
yeah.
You know who I am? Hard to tell Bob Bondurant. No, sir. But anyway, he introduced himself, and once I heard his name, I was like, okay, yeah, I know a little bit about you. You're a pretty bad boy in your day. Anyway, he had a school. He just moved from Sears Point to Phoenix, and because I lived in Phoenix, he was looking for instructors, and I guess he liked something that he'd seen in us, so he asked me to come interview, and I did, and And I worked there for probably 4, 5, 6 years.
Did your brother live in Phoenix at the time too?
No, he lived here. He would prep the cars and meet me at the tracks, and I would both drive, you know, me from Phoenix and from
here. So you would just show up with your helmet?
I was a factory driver.
Factory driver. Did you hear that, Dennis?
Yeah, at that time it just worked out. He loves that part of it, and he had more time than I did, and it was a way for him to stay involved. So he'd take the cart home and prep the cart during the week, and I'd show up.
Was there two? He raced two, or he just prepped?
No, he was just crew chief.
All right.
There's a lot of work. There's a lot going on to race one. So, and he just, I don't know, as we evolved, he liked that part, and I liked the other part. So it worked out good for me. Unfortunately, it didn't last forever. But so I went to work for Bondurant, which was really good because that gave me the opportunity to meet a lot of different people and propel myself to another level of racing, which at the time I had no experience in. But I actually landed a company called ASC, the people who test and certify automotive technicians. The president of that company actually came through the school. When you go through the Bondurant school, you're a student there for 4 days, and it's kind of a really cool thing because here I was, a 25, 26, maybe 27-year-old kid, and here's this CEO guy, you know, from some big corporations that come through this school. They're in their usually 40s, maybe 50s, something they've always wanted to do, experience, and they're at your, you know, they look at you as, okay, you're the expert here. I'm just a dummy. And nowhere else, you know, are they looked at like that. So it's kind of cool because once you have their attention, and it wasn't hard to get their attention, the school would start off in a 15-passenger Ford van. And the knucklehead instructors, including myself, were, you know, it was a competition to see who could get that thing up on two wheels the most. With 15 guys in.
Oh, my God.
And those guys, that was probably the most memorable thing when you talk to somebody that went to the Bondurant school, at least in those days. That's probably the most memorable thing they'll tell you about was the van ride. Like, yeah, we got your attention right out of the box. Probably scared you. That all ended because one of the guys put the van on the side, and it was a pretty ugly deal. Nobody got hurt, but
you got in trouble.
That ended.
And it wasn't you.
Not me.
Oh, okay.
I had a threshold.
And then, so from Bondurant, I heard a rumor that you, sometimes they would send NASCAR drivers through there to learn how to road race.
They did. That was early days of NASCARs coming into road racing. So, and Ford, this was a Ford-backed school, and I worked there. So the Ford drivers would come at least once a year. Usually before Sears Point, before they go around Sears Point. So.
Gary, you're a Ford driver. Did you go through that?
No.
Okay.
No.
We missed you. Where were you at?
Probably in California.
That was a really cool time. I got to, you know, teach, sit beside, and work with guys that are better than me. But the difference was I had the ability to show them the things they were doing right and wrong. I could critique them. Doesn't mean I can run better than them or I'm better than them. It just means that I do it every day as a teacher. So when someone gets in a car next to you, I'm sitting next to Mark Martin, and the cars we're driving, the tracks we're driving, we know by the back of our hand because we've done it so many thousands of times. So I can sit next to Mark Martin and keep smacking his hand off the shifter because he had a really bad habit of driving one hand.
Yeah.
How many people can say that? And when I see him, he still remembers that because, like, Mark, we're road racing. You got to have two hands on the wheel all the time.
Yeah.
Little things like that. But we're really cool, you know, as a young kid to be able to, you know, these are guys that you look at like, man, I'd like to race where he races. But it's just cool. It was a cool time. I got to meet a lot of cool guys like that. Old school guys.
So your ASC connection landed you, they were starting that little truck series deal.
Started as a winter series, didn't it? Like a tryout?
Well, before I did the trucks, I did off-road stadium short track racing,
oh,
Mickey
right.
Thompson. And that's where I took ASC. I didn't know any better or different, or I had never driven a stock car or anything that goes around in a circle on a pavement other than road racing stuff, and never had driven an off-road car.
How'd you get that? So you're like, okay, I'm a really good road racer, and now I think I'm going to be good at jumping trucks in the stadium.
Because I didn't look at it like that. I looked at it like, here's an opportunity with
a
sponsor.
Challenge. Yeah.
And the sponsor needs a specific, has a specific goal and a need. And I needed to meet that need. And the need was 40,000 people on a Saturday night that fits their demographics in racing.
Nice.
And I just looked at that and said, okay, that's what we got to go do. They had the money to do it. That was their market, their demographics. And I just said, well, I'm the
dummy.
They
could have picked any dummy, and they picked you.
Yeah, I said, I'm the dummy that's going to go do this.
That sounds so fun, though.
And it was really fun.
Yeah.
And when I look back on it, funnest race I ever did.
Yeah.
If I had my rathers today, I'd go do that.
Well, there's some off-road races. There is.
It's just, again, I'm over that spending the money to race myself.
Yeah.
You can't do it and make money, or at least break even. With me, I don't do it.
Yeah.
I learned that lesson. But the funny part was, I'm in the first race of my time in that series in Seattle, Washington, in the Kingdom. They always raced in indoor, not indoor, but stadiums, big football stadiums. And the guy who ran that thing, I remember to this day, like it was, he's standing here in front of me. I flipped that car about at least four times that night in practice. Just learn. And I wasn't afraid to try and throw it out there. And that can sometimes get you in a lot of trouble. I was young and dumb. And anyway, we'd fix the car and go right back out. And about the fourth time, I'm laying upside down in the middle of the corner, waiting on corner workers to come flip you back over. Most of the time, it was, you know, just cosmetic stuff. They'd roll you off and you go fly again. And this guy looks under, he looks inside the car and he says, TJ, welcome to off-road racing. And I still laugh about that to this day. Like, you knucklehead, just flip me back over and let me go. It was fun, though. That was a lot of... I took the same group of people that helped me in go-karts, my brother, and, you know, we all got together. I ran that team out of Phoenix, because that's where I was living, and that required a lot more maintenance than a go-kart. So that worked for a while. And then you talk about the truck series. That kind of was petering out, and everybody noticed it. For whatever reason, knew that, okay, if we're going to do stay in racing and we got sponsors, got to take care of them before you worry about what you're doing. That was my theory. So, you know, we proposed to them that, hey, look, there's this little truck series that's coming on through NASCAR. A bunch of off-road guys, in fact, started that. And we have an opportunity to maybe, you know, try our hand at that, take your money and run with that. And they're okay with that. Still fit their demographics. They had me doing a lot of personal service contract stuff where I would go to schools and recruit kids and take cars and, you know, do pit stop competitions at high schools. They were trying to recruit kids into automotive industry and get them to go to college. There are a lot of benefits. Ford had a program, Toyota had a program, everybody had a program. So that was kind of cool. Gave me an opportunity to do what I like to do. Changed me, though, because here I am off-road racing, and I got okay at it. I won a few races. I wasn't the greatest, but I got okay and could win some races and keep them happy. And then all of a sudden, we're changing and going to oval. So the first race was winter heat stuff in Tucson, Arizona. And here's TJ in... I got lucky, and again, some people helped me out, bought a truck, put some things together last minute, showed up at the racetrack, never been on an oval before in my entire life, never ran pavement on an oval in my entire life, and here I am in this 3,400-pound truck, and I'm throwing this thing around like a dirt car, and I smack the wall, and my guys, there you go, my guys on the radio come on the radio and say, hey, you can bring that thing in? For what? I'm out here running laps trying to learn. I think you need to bring that thing in. So I bring it in, and lo and behold, they're standing there just looking at me, and I get out of the car, and I walk to the other side of the car. I'm like, it's about 1 foot narrower than it was before I hit the wall. And I looked at that car, and I said, my goodness, I thought I just barely tapped the wall.
Oh,
to
wow.
me, it felt that
right.
way. But the difference in the way the cars are built, it absorbed that. It has crush panels. And the whole side of that truck was flat. The problem was you have to meet even then, templates before the start of that race. So I didn't get to practice anymore because my guys and other guys were out there fixing this car and beating it back and trying to get it to where it makes
sense. Well, here's what it looked like before you wrecked it. And if you want your very own diecast of it, it's available on eBay right now.
Speaking of the diecast, at what point in your life did you realize, holy crap, I have like a diecast car? Like, did that affect you at any time? Did you have that moment where you just kind of laughed and went, holy crap?
The moment was the first time I got a check for it. They had come to us and talked to you about doing that, and they had two options. One was you could take royalties off base how many sold, or you take a lump sum. And to me at the time, it was like, I have no idea where that'll go, what it'll take. So the guy, pretty cool about it, he told me that, you know, better to take the royalties. So I thought, okay, do that. And first time I got a paycheck, I was like, wow, free money. I was blown away by that. But if you look at that, I mean, not most, but guys that made their name, the Jeff Gordons, Dale Earnhardts, they made more money off stuff like that than they ever did racing.
Yeah.
Really? That's crazy.
2 weeks ago, my daughter, her boyfriend, friends with Kyle Larson. Kyle Larson was racing a dirt late model.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, first time. Somebody else.
And won.
And won.
Yeah.
He got $2,500 for the win. He split the purse. The deal was he got half the purse, so it was $5,000 purse. But he sold $100,000 in T-shirts that night.
$100,000 in T-shirts?
And his answer was, well, that's what I came for.
Right on.
But again, a guy like Kyle Larson with a name like Kyle Larson can do that. And that's why when you say, you know, famous driver, I wasn't. I had to do extra things to try and stay in that game and be in that world because I didn't have that kind of name. And I owned my own team.
So you put everything you had into it.
Yeah, I was an owner driver.
So that was like 1995 when you started?
Yeah, 95, 90, 90. I think I ran till 97 or 98. That was a very, very good time, very hard time. A lot of people don't understand how hard that is to do that. I did it out of Phoenix. I started in Phoenix. And most of the races are East Coast.
Mm.
So the driving, which I also participated in, driving a semi-rig, was a lot of work. Back and forth, traveling. The traveling part is probably the hardest part. Even the guys today that do it for a living that don't have to drive, the traveling part is what hurts them the most.
And you were married at the time?
I was with two kids. Both my little kids were little, which is part of why I stopped racing. Some things transpired. Had a big dollar sponsor coming down the pipeline, everything but signed, and lasted on the last minute. Politic kind of deal. I won't even go into it, but it changed my thinking.
It's not all about the racing. It's.
Yeah, I realized one thing with my kids is my son was probably 5 or 6, maybe when I first started with Mickey Thompson stuff. He was probably 9 or 10. And the one thing that I struggled with the most was he would chase me down the street when I was leaving to go racing every Thursday or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be running down the street on his bike, or he'd hide in my car, or. Whatever. It just would break your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually I realized.
That's with my dogs.
Yeah, me too now. It just changed my thinking, my way of thinking. I can come back and do this. I need to be around for my kids. The racing stuff is so hard. It's hard on everything, your marriage, your kids, your life, everything. Because you're just never around. And you think that you can overcome that. And you think, I'll bring them to the races here, there, whatever. Or I'll go home and spend this week, and something always blows it up. Racing life is not what everyone thinks it is. Yeah, there's some. So to me, it wasn't even the limelight of it. I didn't care for that. But what I liked was just when I'm in a seat. like most race car guys, when I'm in the seat, even today.
Yep.
Best time I have, for me, it's different. When I'm driving a legend car, I call it my Spencer time.
Yeah.
Because it's when I feel closest to my son. And
which makes that choice, that sacrifice of not going full racing and spending the time with your kids, makes it worth it now. You got to spend more time with your kids.
Funny, the part about that was my wife and I decided we need to give up the racing, just kind of burned out on ups and downs of it. We thought we were making the choice, you know, we're standing in the moment, so what are we going to do next, yada, yada, and everything finds its way into fruition. But later, when I look back on it, as things transpired in my life, you all know I lost my son, and you all know who he was. When I look back on when I stopped racing, I believe it was God intervening in me and making that time change for me and putting me in a place where, because only he knows what tomorrow will bring. I had no idea. I never even dreamed of or thought of that my son wouldn't be here to the age of 20. But when I look back on it, I tell people this all the time. That time that I spent with him because he went racing and we did the racing thing together for the next 12 years, I'm very grateful for that because it was more time spent with him than most people will spend with their kid in a lifetime if their kid lives to be as old as they are.
Yeah.
That is just I just did it in a shorter amount of time, shorter amount of years.
So you quit racing. How did it transpire that Spencer goes racing then?
I wish it wouldn't have. I tried to get him to do anything. Bought golf clubs, took him out to the Nellis Air Base, watched the airplane, and said, you gotta do that. That looks way cool to me and way less stressful. But, man, he'd always come back and say, not that. That's not what I want to do. I want to drive race cars. So, as a father, you do what you can to make that come about.
What'd you stick him in first?
You know, I just, because of my teaching background and because of what I had done myself in the racing world, I kind of had an idea of what I thought it would take to reach that point of what most guys want to reach. You know, every race car driver will tell you, I'm going to be a cup driver. And unfortunately, that's a really far reach, especially in today's world. So I always looked at it different. I worked it backwards. And my feeling was this, okay, I don't have the kind of money that it would take to take him to that level of racing. But what I do have are the skills to teach him how to do it if he got there. So I spent my time. I didn't care what we were racing. It was all about just trying to prepare him with the set of skills that when he got the opportunity, that he'd knock the socks off somebody. That was my entire goal was to, I had a little process. The legend cars, I think, are one of the greatest tools that we have as race car guys to learn in. They provide a lot of good foundation for drivers at any level. And then from there, it's just, the bigger, if you're going to drive a 3,400-pound car, you need to get in a 3,400-pound car so you can. Because nobody cares. I shouldn't say that. And I guess I struggle because I tell parents this all the time, and they look at me like, wow, that's not what we want to hear. But nobody at the cup level, if that's where you're headed, cares about your legend car championships or cares about your skid plate championships or cares about your SRL or even, the highest level of any kind of racing. What they care about is how well you can drive that 3,400-pound car.
But some of that comes from that experience in the legends and the dirt track. I mean, you look at the Busch brothers and you look at some of these other short track drivers, from kids, go-karts, dirt track. You can see when stuff happens on the track, how they react and how they control the car. You can tell who's an iRacer and who's a track driver. You can tell just by the way the car spins and the car reacts.
Well, that's an interesting point, though, because both of them went from Legends to Super Lays, for example.
Yeah.
And that's what you did with Spencer, right?
Well, you have. I'm not saying you can't do those or shouldn't do those. You should. Every level is important, and every level provides something different. And it's all about experience and decision making. Driving a race car to me is you're a decision maker. It constantly everything in your in front of you is changing constantly. And how good are you at memorizing what your car is doing, where you're at on track, who you're racing with, all those things, because you are changing direction, you're changing your mind, you're changing decision-making on and on. And you only get that in one way, challenged on the racetrack. I can go test, and I can be the fastest guy on the track because I'm the only one testing. But it's not the same as when you're wheel-to-wheel battling somebody. And that's what is important for any kid is and that's why I say the guys at the top level understand there's a process to learn how to race. They get that, and they just assume that you already know how to race. But how well do you drive this car, this kind of car? They're real specific about that. They don't care how you can drive an Indy car. They care less. They're going to hire you to drive their 3,400-pound car. They want to know you can wheel that car.
And then back then, wasn't there like a talent something that Spencer got in and there were like 100 drivers and he was like top five or something? What was that?
That was a go-kart thing.
That was a go-kart thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was actually locally here, the indoor go-kart track. And he was into that. I don't even.
He always said fast time.
Yeah. He worked at it.
Yeah.
He went there a lot, and he worked at it.
Yeah.
And he just had that sheer determination.
Yeah.
He always would tell me, I'm here to win. I don't lose, Dad. Okay. So what I liked, and I have not seen as much, is his ability to overcome and to dig deep within. And
yeah.
make things happen. That's a trait that you can't teach. You can teach them how to drive. I tell people, I teach a monkey to drive the race car. But what I can't do is teach them how to think while he's driving a car and how to make those decisions we were talking about.
Well, and you're spending a lot of time teaching a lot of young drivers now. So is that what you're teaching them?
Yeah, I pretty much teach them all the same thing.
Yeah.
Just, again, it's a process. Easy to duplicate. It just, unfortunately, in today's world, it's kids are different. They're not doing the same things what we did when we were kids.
Interesting. Yeah, that's, we brought that up every now and then, a couple on the show, about kids who don't even go get their driver's license. I was 16. I was like standing in line, like waiting for the doors to open. These kids, 18, 19. And they get it when they have to because their job happens to be 10 miles away instead of 2, and the bus doesn't go there. And
yeah,
just, yeah, I don't get that, you know, being that kid that was like, couldn't wait to get into the car by myself. No
mm-hmm.
mom, no dad, no uncles, just I'm driving by myself.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't wait.
Yeah. Kevin Terrell said that was the Red Bull driver search.
I think it was. Mm-hmm. They took the top two guys from each area and had a little thing down in, I think it was at Willow Springs, to be honest, Mike Manning racetrack. I didn't get to go. My wife went. And Spencer was like, the winner of that deal, he got some open wheel ride, got to represent American.
Yeah, didn't like Jaskol do that?
He did it on a different avenue. I don't remember exactly how that worked out. I just know Spencer was driving late models at the time, and he was like, "Dad, do I do this? Like, why wouldn't you? Well, what if I win, or what if they want me to do it? We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Do you want to drive over wheel cars?" He says, "No." I said, "Well, who cares? Go win the thing, and then tell her if you had to turn him down, you turn him down."
Yeah.
To me, it's experience. Go race with the best kids out there, and learn something.
That's cool.
And he went. And he was right up there in the best of them. He was right in there with them. He said, I remember, and it wasn't just him saying it, but He was like, I should have won, Dad. I should have won. Some chick took me out.
Oh, yeah, those chick drivers out there.
Chick. Some girl. I don't remember any of the names of kids that were doing that, but it was funny because Danny Sullivan was IndyCar driver was the guy running it. And I remember getting a phone call from my wife saying, do you know this guy? I did not. She says, he won't even give Spencer time of day. I said, well, why do you think that is? And she says, I don't know. I said, well, look around the other little kids. Are they all little go-kart kids? Yeah. How do you know that? Well, their suits are different. Their helmets are different. I said, okay, what is Spencer wearing? Stock car suit, has the cuffs up here. He got his helmet on with a breather on top, wires hanging out of it. Well, he doesn't fit. He's a stock car guy, and he wore his stock car stuff, and they know that. So, yeah, they don't let that stock car kid come in here and steal their thunder.
No.
Go-kart kid.
Yeah.
So I get that. But anyway, it was a very good thing for him to do. And, again, another opportunity. And any kid that gets an opportunity to do that, I'd say do it. Absolutely.
Before you put him in a super late, though, you guys both raced the Legends car. What was your thought with that? Is that to, like, push him or is it show him how it's done? Or?
Yeah, that ended up being a deal that I'm very, very thankful for. And, again, not knowing at the time, but the memories that I have now, very, very thankful for that. But it wasn't something I intended to do. It's just something that came about through some things that happened on the racetrack, I'll just say. Him and Kyle were always going at it, and Spencer was the new kid on the block. And it was a time where fans were looking for somebody to cheer for. They had been cheering for Kyle because Kyle won all the races up to that point, and then here comes a little kid that's 2 years younger and runs with him. Didn't put it to him right away, just ran with him. And soon as Spencer wins, you know, Kyle being Kyle gets a little frustrated at that and does some dumb things, and Spencer retaliates and does some dumb things, and the next thing you know, we're all in the principal's office having to deal with, you know, the head boomba. And some things were said and done in that meeting that I didn't agree with. I'm trying to teach my son to be respectful on the racetrack and not take things from people and not push people around. And, you know, I'm okay with you being a hard charging aggressive race car driver and learning how to intimidate people. You can do it by just pulling up on their bumper and then looking in the mirror, but you don't have to, you know, knock them out of the way and spin them out, especially on a, you know, an ongoing basis. And the guy who runs the track out there was doing a great job of running it and talking about, you know, what's allowed and what's not and who's responsible, and, you know, when you get into a situation, who's not and who is. And they had it going real well, and then all of a sudden something changed. One race, Spencer ran in the back of Kyle, spun him out, won the race. Spencer blasted him after the race, and Spencer got suspended for it. A guy by the name of Jeff Wolf called a little meeting. He wanted to know why and how that transpired and why both kids didn't get in trouble instead of just one. And he asked me, he calls and says, hey, would you like to go with me? And I'm like, yeah, I'd like to hear that one too. Because I'm still trying to figure out how that worked out. But so I went to that meeting, and again, some things happened and then were said in that meeting that I didn't agree with, because it was told, well, when the first place driver, the leader, goes on to the last lap, white flag comes out, he's open game. What do you mean he's open game? Well, if he changes his line when he goes into turn one,
you're allowed to just take him out.
Second place guy wants to run into him, he can't. I was like, no.
That's a new rule.
That's what I said. That's exactly what I said. That's a new rule. Are you going to implement that rule and then drives me tell everybody that new rule exists? Well, I will. And by the way, I'll be in a car too. Because if you're going to say that that's a rule, I'm a jerk. I admit it.
I just came out and said,
if I'm in second, I don't care who's in front. They're going to the moon, just so you know. Because I don't agree with your rule. Maybe you'll change it afterwards. And I got and walked out of that meeting frustrated. And I realized when I walked out, I think I just stepped on my toes with golf shoes because I've never driven a car. But So next week, Spencer got wrecked, and Kyle was leading the race, and TJ's car was really good. I was able to pull up alongside him and give him a little wave, drive by him, and then do a little Dyson with him, and then realize I need to be in second place. There's only like 5 or 6 laps to go, so I just moved over, let him go, and he was in front, stayed on his tail, and the last lap, I was going to send him to the moon. He knew it. Everybody else knew it. I was real vocal about it. And Kyle just overdrove the corner.
He took himself out.
It was intimidation. He was right. So intimidated that he was
so worried
about me that he just overdrove turn one. And he slid up the track, and I drove underneath him, looked at him, and waved at him, and drove on and won the race.
Nice.
And that was the only race that I won that entire year. And he won the previous one because he took Spencer out. Guess who won the rest? All 28 of them. Spencer Clark. And yes, I did continue to race that entire year because I had so much fun doing it. And it was an opportunity for me to push those kids harder. Because I did have skills back then, probably not anymore, but at least then I was able to run with those kids. And it actually, for Spencer, more than Kyle, it gave Spencer, I used to call him the Iceman, because I could get on his tail and shake him any way I wanted, touch him anywhere I wanted, not anywhere I wanted, but in places that I knew would shake his tree. You know, most drivers would shake their tree. They'd look in the mirror, make a mistake or whatever, and he would just, like, nod his head like, yeah, right. And it taught him those lessons.
Yeah, that's good.
So it was really good. An opportunity to actually improve his skills on a quicker learning level. To me, that's no different than you run with the best guys out there, whoever they are, you learn a lot quicker.
That's right.
Anywhere you go. That's why a lot of guys in town locally, and I don't care what level of racing it is, really good on your track. It's your hometown event. You go somewhere else and you get your butt handed to you, and you're like, wow, I guess I'm not as good as I thought I was.
Yeah. And when I first started racing, there was over 100 different drivers. We had C mains, and that was the thing. Like, I didn't want to race a lower class. I wanted to win against those guys. I wanted to learn from those guys. So
that's the smartest thing you could do right there. I want to learn from the best.
Yeah. And when I finally won, it was like, no way. So crazy. And then they had this women's series. It's like I Rock Women's Series.
Powder Puff.
It was, it was like.
Those chicks.
I was waiting for
it. It was, they were trying to do more diversity. And so they had started this,
Powder Puff.
It was like, they were like I Rock cars. And they raced like Laguna Seca, Stairs Point. And everybody's like, you should do it. It was like
a full-blown race car?
No, it was like a Miata.
Oh, okay.
And
like
I was like,
kid plate,
why would I? I was like, I'm not going to do that because, so then I'm the fastest chick driver? What is that? That doesn't mean anything. Yeah, I want to be a late model champion at Madeira, So.
Big difference. I agree.
So you guys, after the Legends car, besides the fact I was selling my super late, and so what made you in the market?
I ended up with your hand-me-downs. So I don't know.
But you were in the market at that time. How did
Spencer wanted to move to the next class, which at the time, actually, we did some speed truck stuff because they let him run at 14.
The ASA?
Right. This is a time when 18 was the age, I believe, even on late model stuff. They changed it shortly after that so he could run at 16. It might have been 16. I don't know. I'm so old, I forget. But anyway, the process was let him get some seat time in those speed trucks because he could do it at 14. My feeling is move yourself up as soon as you're capable and as quickly as you can to get, so you don't get stuck. So we did the speed truck stuff, and he had a lot of success at the speed truck stuff, won a lot of races, and did real well with that. He drove for me. He drove for some other Mike Seavey, a couple different people. He drove for some guys out of California a couple different times. So he had a lot of success in the speed truck. So by the time he was 16, he was like, okay, well now he wants to do the late model stuff. He liked racing here in Las Vegas
because that was the featured division here.
At the time, super lates. That was the feature division. You know, he figured he's ready for it. So we said, all right, well, we'll step out there and go find the car. Can't buy or build a new one. We'll just go get some clunker. Just happened to be the clunker that Cindy Clark drove. And she tells me this years later, so it's like, really? Did I take you out of a ride or anything?
No, no. I didn't own that car. It was a Resnicki car,
a local car that, you know, it's what we could afford, it's what we could do. And Spencer, it had an older body on it. That's one thing I remember. Because Spencer was like, Dad, can we change that body at least? And I was like, no, why would we do that? I need you to go out there to spend your year
bashing it up.
Knocking the body off. When you knock it off, we'll replace it.
Yeah.
And when I said that, he just kind of looked at me, and we went the entire season with one fender.
He never knocked it off.
At the end of the year, he's like, okay, Dad, now can we change the body?
That's
all right, now we can change the body, buddy.
That's cool.
So, yeah, we did that for, I think, 2 seasons. And then 18 was the age for
nice.
K&N, yeah. K&N stuff, mm-hmm. K&N West. So at 17, I told him, I look here. If we're going to go run at 18, we got to prepare at 17.
And why the West Series and not? That back then, they had the Southwest Tour.
To me, again, I wasn't a stock car guy originally, so I didn't do any of the local track late model racing. And when I looked at the cost, that was a great series, and it still is, but the cost of doing that was no different than doing the 3,200-pound car that we talked about earlier that he needed to drive.
Because those West cars used to be
27
old cup cars.
The West cars, yes, were full-blown cup cars with a little milder motor in.
Yeah.
And so again, from the recruitment standpoint, if someone's looking at you, they didn't care that you could drive that 2,700-pound car
right.
fast and win championships. They just didn't care. So to me, it was like, well, I got limited funds. I can't do both. In fact, I couldn't even do the West Series full-time. We had to pick and choose. So when we first started out, I had to sell that late model car to purchase a West car. I actually went back to Charlotte area because I'd known a few people there and just kind of went and picked and choose and found a couple-year-old car that was real good. And I brought it out here and we just started testing it. Spencer was like, well, Dad, I got to race something else full-time. Yeah, I guess you can run that legend car you got. So he, on his own, went to Dick Cobb and asked Dick Cobb, because Dick Cobb at that time had a handful of cars, wasn't racing much of them. And it just made sense, I guess. So he asked Dick, will you let me drive your car? I'll make you a deal. You keep race winnings. We can win some races. And Dick said, well, what are you going to do for motor? Let me work that out. Spencer goes to Resnicki and says, Steve's local motor builder, says, Steve, I need a motor. And we had enough success that Steve probably would have helped him regardless. But Spencer says, I'll let your son, Bear, drive my legend car, and I'll help him if you'll help me with a motor.
That's cool.
So on his own,
he's already
he put
really,
that deal
yeah,
together.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Except the first race out, got in a wreck, knocked the clip off the car. So dad had to get back involved and help fix the car because the race was next week. I was like, man, that wasn't part of the deal. We got our own car to work on.
And then didn't Bear wreck his car?
He did a few times. Him and Spencer would spat like kids. Spencer was tough. He felt like if you're going to ask me for help, you're going to listen to me. Probably something that I had.
Oh, yeah, something
him.
Like his dad.
Yeah.
Where he got that from.
So he was a great teacher, and I think anybody that worked under him will tell you that. He didn't take their excuses, or you know, he wanted them to be like he was, and he wanted them to be as good as he was. He wanted to race.
But he also earned that. Just like.
Yeah, and I think it's true. The stuff you pick
like
up.
The respect
there.
That most of us have for you, you know, you've earned that.
Yeah, but you know what? Spencer did have a heart of gold. As hard ass as he was, like
yeah.
So many people. Were affected by your son through him helping them. Like
right.
If you broke down, he was first in your pits to help you put it back together. Whether he liked you or not.
I learned a hard lesson about that. That's why Spencer Clark Driven Foundation exists today, because I
too stupid, too involved with my own. I always had my head under our hood, working on our car, trying to make him better, that I never really looked around and saw, you know, people need help. Spencer did. He helped a lot of people that I never even knew that he helped. I knew he was doing a lot of, you know, he was starting building, working on legend cars and helping most kids in this town that have been through them. You know, the Dustin Nash and Justin Johnsons and, you know, a whole bunch of them. Kevin Terrell, a whole bunch of them. He would work on their cars.
Kevin Terrell doesn't actually race. He just has them in his garage.
That's right.
He just moves on to them.
Well, he did race it one time. He even drove my car.
Oh, that's right.
He even drove the Spencer Clark driven car.
Love you, Kevin.
Car. Yeah, Kevin, love you, buddy. So, yeah, Spencer had a heart of gold. And, you know, after we lost him, even to this day, I have people come to me and say, man, your kid helped me more than anybody's ever helped me. And I was really blown away. There's a kid out there. Most of you probably heard of him, Ryan Partridge. He's raced a lot of stuff. And I think he was pretty close to Spencer's age. And he was struggling in his racing stuff. And somehow Spencer hooked up with him, helping him out. And this kid, I had no idea until like 3 years after Spencer's gone. He has a tattoo right here on the side of him. That big.
Aww.
Basketball size of Spencer. A mural of Spencer.
Huh. Very cool.
And when I heard that, I was like, why would someone, what the heck? And I knew who the kid was, and we're at a track somewhere, I don't even remember where, but he comes over and asks to borrow some tires for a legend car. Again, this kid struggled a little. Yeah, dude, I'll loan you some tires. Hey, Art, somebody told me that's the kid. I didn't know who he was at the time. That's the kid that has Spencer's tattoo. I said, hey, come here, dude. You got a tattoo of Spencer? And the kid just started crying.
Aww.
I mean, it had me in tears. He's like, man, I've always wanted to come talk to you and tell you.
How much you meant to you.
Yeah, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. But I show me your tattoo, dude. Rips up the shirt. Wow. That's crazy. That kid loves Spencer so much. He told me some stories. And he loves Spencer so much. I mean, imagine, I guess, this is weird. And not weird, just heartfelt.
But is it, yeah, as a parent...
There's
you
only like
feel so proud.
Yeah.
We only have 3 minutes left, believe it or not, but I want to get to, you know, he went rest racing and kind of shook up that whole series. You
yeah.
know, I worked for some West teams back then, and everybody was like,
you were going back
in it was like, you guys came on scene and just blew everybody away and pissed a lot of people off because he was fast right out the gate, and he was all these, you know, million-dollar teams, and they're like, who is this, and how did he beat us all? With that, it was great.
Well, that's what we've always done our
yeah.
entire life. And Spencer was real easy because he was just that good. And you're right. I mean, we showed up at Phoenix Lake NASCAR. You have to go through a process and be licensed, and they want to see you on short tracks. But with his background, they let him run the day he turned 18 in Phoenix.
That's cool.
Which was unusual, but it was kind of cool they did that.
Yeah.
Anyway, he showed up there and sat on the poles.
Yeah.
I still remember I had my headset on in NASCAR. The head guy, the head tech NASCAR guy says, comes on the radio and says, can you verify that time? And somebody else comes on the radio and told the time. And they said, okay, so your clock says that? They were checking clocks between each other because they couldn't believe the time.
Right.
And the NASCAR guy says, make sure that car goes to tech. I want to look at that car.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what's 60 seconds left. Is there anything that you really wanted to say that we didn't get to tonight?
No, I appreciate everyone involved in this racing. You guys trying to help keep racing alive. I think we're going to struggle in the near future. I'm hoping our track really pays attention. This track puts out a lot of good race car drivers. Very competitive, probably one of the most competitive places in the country. And I really hope to see it falter. Really like to see this track come back. So I'm in, and I encourage everybody else to participate as much as you can.